On the 15th of May 1940, Winston Churchill was woken up rather early by a phone call. I say rather early, that's relative. Churchill didn't get up at a particularly early time in the morning generally, so it was probably a normal time by other people's standards. But anyway, he was still in bed. And it was the Prime Minister of France, Paul Reynaud. And Reynaud poured into the phone his sense of despair about the German breakthrough on the Meuse. And he said to Churchill in English, "We are beaten. We have lost the battle." So 5 days after the German offensive had begun, 5 days after Churchill had formed his government, and indeed he was still in the process of forming his government, he was suddenly woken up by his principal ally and told, "It's over. It's finished." He raced to Paris, raced as far as one can in a pre-Eurostar era. I think he arrived on the 17th. There was a rather intense meeting at the Quai d'Orsay with the French High Command. Churchill presents a very vivid account of it in his memoirs, possibly rather over-coloured, but it certainly was a meeting that he never forgot. General Gamelin, who was the high commander at the time, explained the situation in very bleak terms, as Churchill put it. Eventually, Churchill asked, in what he said was his own rather indifferent French, so there has been a breakthrough, but where is the strategic reserve? Où est la masse de manœuvre? And as he presents it, Gamelin looked at him and he said, "Aucune, aucune." There's almost a sense of British stereotype of a Gallic shrug. Aucune. Churchill said he was so shaken by this, he walked over to the window, and in the garden he could see, as he put it, venerable functionaries, elderly gentlemen, with wheelbarrows of documents that they were putting onto a bonfire. They were already 5 days into the war burning the documents in Paris. It was a kind of bonfire of the vanities of the Fourth Republic, and it was something that, a moment that Churchill never forgot. Why this happened, of course, has been a subject of long debate ever since. Mark Bloch wrote a famous book about the strange defeat. Ernest May, an American historian, wrote, I think, a seriously neglected, very important book called Strange Victory, suggesting that the German victory was indeed, in large measure, a matter of luck and chance. I have written about it, Julian Jackson's written about it. It remains a matter of debate. It's not something to go into today in great detail. But certainly, to a significant extent, the fact that the Germans decided this time, belatedly, to not to mount a right hook through Belgium, but a left hook through the Ardennes, and through, therefore, the soft and unprepared part of the French and British front, was fundamentally important. In this offensive, speed was of the essence. Using the word speed in both a temporal and a metabolic sense, because German tank drivers were on amphetamines so that they could drive day and night, 48, 72 hours to get to Sedan. It was, so there was, I think, a large element of luck and good fortune in this. In 1914, of course, France had had a miracle, the miracle on the Marne. In 1940, the miracle was at Dunkirk, and that saved the British. It didn't save France. So in 4 weeks, a jumped-up Austrian corporal had done what the Kaiser's best generals had never been able to do in the course of the First World War: break the Western Front, knock France out of the war. And as a result, the shape of the Second World War was fundamentally different from the First. And I want to argue the shape of Anglo-French relations was changed fundamentally in ways that are still with us today. So that was the road that was taken in 1940 through the Ardennes to Dunkirk, if you like. France sued for an armistice. Britain, in Churchill's words, was left alone. Again, a slightly figurative term, considering that there were also the countries of the Dominions who were of huge importance in 1940, and very soon Greece was joining in the battle. But nevertheless, the image of Britain alone is one that has lingered powerfully in the British imagination. For France, it was a story of an armistice, of the hero of Verdun, Pétain, coming as saviour of the nation in the immediate instance, but of course eventually his whole reputation deeply tarnished by the collaboration and the stigma of Vichy. I was at Verdun a few weeks ago and was looking at the grave that he should have occupied had he not been exiled and convicted of treason. It's still there. It now carries the body of a very different general of no great significance, but it's a reminder that Pétain was supposed to head his troops at Douaumont, and he still lies in ignominious exile elsewhere. So that is the road taken in 1940. It's a familiar story. Let me take you to a road not taken in 1940, which I think is of considerable interest. Ever since 1919, ever since the Paris Peace Conference, the British had spent their time trying to avoid commitments to France and French security on the continent, and particularly in Eastern Europe. There was indeed a general view in the British Foreign Office that in many ways the French were the main problem of British foreign policy in the 20s, their attempts to entangle Britain in continental alliances. Fast forward to the winter of 1938-39, after the Rhineland, after Austria, after the Czech crisis, and then finally Hitler's breach of the Munich Agreement when he marches into Prague in March. A growing recognition by the British that the policy of keeping the French at arm's length, of not making security commitments to the French against Germany, had been fundamentally mistaken. And a recognition once war began that British policy in the future ought to be rather different. I want to read to you for a moment or two a long minute that was written by Orme Sargent, who was Deputy Undersecretary at the Foreign Office in the Second World War. I think we all know that sometimes Foreign Office minutes should not be taken too seriously. They are written for a variety of purposes. Professor. But that's off the record, Ambassador. Shocked. So, well, I want to shock a few. But what I do think this is one that is worth thinking about, and just the language is quite interesting. So this is 28th of February, 1940. During the Twilight War, as it was known at the time, Sargent wrote a minute suggesting that the only alternative to France after the war demanding a punitive peace against Germany would be to reassure the French that, he says, that after the war they could count on such a system of close and permanent cooperation between France and Great Britain, political, military, and economic, as will, for all international purposes, make of the two countries a single unit in post-war Europe. Such a unit would constitute an effective, perhaps the only effective, counterweight to the unit of 80 million Germans in the middle of Europe. This, he said, was the only way to achieve a stable peace. But, Sargent continued, the British public is quite unprepared for such a development. It would at first sight appear to most as an alarming and dangerous surrender of Great Britain's liberty of action, or maybe of sovereignty. And it will need a considerable amount of education before the British public will get accustomed to the notion of their having to make this, what he calls, unpalatable and unprecedented sacrifice on the altar of European peace. He proposed, therefore, that a major campaign of public education should be begun in Britain to try and turn public opinion to more a favourable view of this whole Anglo-French process of cooperation. And what is interesting is that this minute was taken up with enthusiasm by Lord Halifax, the Foreign Secretary, and indeed by Neville Chamberlain, the Prime Minister. Chamberlain noted, "I entirely agree with this memorandum and should be glad if the Ministry of Information can do something to draw attention to the importance of the subject." And over the next few months, so March, April, into May, various committees were set up to explore this process, the policies and implications of a policy of making France and Britain, in international purposes, a single unit in post-war policy. There were also campaigns set in motion with the Ministry of the Board of Education for these ideas to be promulgated in British schools to create a different and more informed impression of France. Now, we obviously should not make too much of these documents and these ideas. There was a great deal of suspicion still in Britain about France, and the actual details of working out any possible policy were very slow and inchoate. But in terms of, if you like, a route map for the future, I think that that document in February 1940 is interesting and illustrative. It suggests the way in which the British might have gone if the Anglo-French alliance had continued as the basis of the British war effort in this Second World War. Instead, of course, the whole idea goes down the drain in May and June 1940. And the British policy now is, quite frankly, by late May, that, as Chamberlain himself puts it, our only hope, it seems to me, lies in Roosevelt and the United States. This turn to the United States is fundamental, not just for the war, but for post-war policy. And it's quite striking that by July, Lord Halifax, who is Foreign Secretary, suggests that the committee about Anglo-French collaboration should now be wound up. Halifax comments, "It may well be that instead of studying closer union with France, we shall find ourselves contemplating the possibility of some sort of special association with the USA." Interesting phrase, special association, not special relationship, but it's there, special association, 3 years before Churchill starts to use the term special relationship in public discussion. And Halifax warns that this is a matter, special association with the Americans, that can't be rushed, but this does not mean that we ought not to bear it always in mind. Henceforth, it ought, I think, to replace the idea of Anglo-French union amongst the various plans which we may make for the future. And that is the mood by the late summer of 1940. Britain is alone insofar as it's not going to be alone for long. The hopes now lie in the United States. This turn, it seems to me, is fundamental in British policy. And for the last few minutes, I want to explore the roads taken after 1945 that both the British and the French pursue. The road after 1945 for France initially is what Sargent had predicted, the ambition for another punitive peace for keeping Germany down, the policy of the early 1920s. And that is indeed the policy of the government in mid-1940s. But faced with British and American refusal or British and American determination to resurrect Germany in peaceful form, there is a fundamental shift, particularly in that rather remarkable period in the late 40s and early 50s, where, if you like, Christian democracy has a hold over French politics. The Mouvement Républicain Populaire is at the forefront of the redesigning of French policy towards one of European integration. And it is, I think, quite striking that the man who is associated with this in public, at least, Robert Schuman, is, of course, a man who is the product of that shifting fluidity of France's eastern borders, a man who grew up in Lorraine, under German rule, who spoke German, who went to German-speaking university, and would have been conscripted into the German army in the First World War, but for getting medical exemption. after the First World War, of course, Lorraine is now back in French hands. Schumann becomes a French politician. He's involved in the resistance during the war. And then in 1950, it falls to him to promulgate the ideas that Jean Monnet had developed for a coal and steel community, bringing France and Germany together, fusing sovereignty in the interests of peace. A philosophy, if you like, of if you can't beat them, join them, moving France and Germany away from this cycle of tit-for-tat wars that had been, you know, going on for several centuries. It takes us through to major events like the Élysée Treaty in 1963, creating a new relationship between France and Germany. And, of course, it seems to me that Franco-German pact is at the heart of the Treaty of Rome in 1957, which is, if you like, the sort of alternative, the surrogate for a peace treaty in the West to end the Second World War. France and Germany bury the hatchet in a way that's absolutely inconceivable in 1945. And although the European Union has grown in strange and complicated ways, ways that are by no means easy to defend always, nevertheless, it seems to me that that essential ambition that this is a pacifying project, a peace-giving project, has been of enormous importance in European history. And the Franco-German relationship at the core of it has been essential to ensure that the second half of the 20th century has been, I think, a lot more peaceful, at least in Western Europe, than it has been, than the first half. So finally, then, the road that, I mean, what I would say finally is that that was, of course, not a road taken by the British after 1945. British policy was to stand aloof from the process of European integration, to place strong emphasis on the special relationship with the United States, and to adopt what was called by one Treasury document in 1949 a policy of limited liability towards European cooperation. Our policy should be to assist Europe to recover as far as we can, but the concept must be one of limited liability. In no circumstances must we assist them beyond the point at which the assistance leaves us too weak to be a worthwhile ally for USA if Europe collapses. That distancing from the European integration process, the sense, as Churchill put it, that it's for them, not us, was fundamental to British policy in the 50s, as you know. By the time the British decided that it was essential to join the project, de Gaulle was in command in France, and for 15 years he essentially was able to keep Britain out of a union which, by the time it joined in 1973, had been formed and shaped in ways that were not conducive to some of Britain's interests. So there has always been that sense of being somewhat on the sidelines ever since. After 2 years after we joined in 1975, Harold Wilson arranged a cosmetic renegotiation to try and keep public opinion happy. We're now engaged in what seems to me to be another process of cosmetic renegotiation leading to another referendum in the next 18 months. And I would suggest that to a significant extent, what we're exploring here and experiencing in the present day are the legacies of the roads taken and not taken in 1940. Thank you very much.